Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on strategic relocation when we come back. The genocidal policy of Global 2000 and this New World Order are the greatest threats to our lives, our liberties, and our property since Noah's flood. And that's not just my opinion. Jesus of Nazareth held that same view when he said in Matthew 24, verse 22, that except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive. Now, there are 64 life-threatening problems described in the Bible detailing this New World Order and their Global 2000 genocide agenda. And the Scripture teaches preparation for that kind of great tribulation, not just apathy and indifference. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I wise up and start listening more to the God of Israel and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's see if we can't live through, see if we can't prepare and survive this Global 2000 New World Order nightmare. Now, if you'd like to do just that, why don't you call or write or email us to the law school and ask for those 64 life-threatening problems from the Scriptures, and let's talk about formulating a real, meaningful, intelligent plan to survive Global 2000 and these other 64 life-threatening problems, which are called the Great Tribulation in Bible prophecy. Why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package first? You know, that's the place to start. It doesn't cost you anything. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational. It's informative. It's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website at georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about a thing here called strategic relocation. Last time I mentioned some historical events, you know, like New Orleans. Wouldn't it have been better had you moved out of New Orleans a year, 2 years, or 5 years ago, rather than stay in New Orleans? And now your house has been totally destroyed, and now you have to rebuild. And, of course, somebody's going to say, well, if I'd have moved out, I'd have just passed that on, and somebody else would be in that boat. And, you know, that's real, and that's reality. Yeah? If you'd have sold your house 5 years ago in New Orleans, somebody would have bought it, and the somebody that bought it would be where you are today, in New Orleans, totally wiped out, and rebuilding your property, fighting with the insurance companies, etc. And, of course, many of you people want to live in New Orleans. I know I want to live where I'm living, and I live in what we call Tornado Alley. Tornado Alley. But here, we prepare for tornadoes. We build our houses to withstand high winds. And we have tornado shelters, concrete bunkers that we go into when tornadoes are approaching. And we're all pretty familiar with the sounds of tornadoes and the weather that leads up to tornadoes and the weather forecasts and the warnings and the sirens and all of the things that go with living in Tornado Alley. We're pretty familiar with that. And we are prepared for a tornado here on this farm today. In fact, I'm prepared for a tornado in the next 60 seconds. 60 seconds, I'm ready. and so are my neighbors, and so are thousands and tens of thousands of others around me. And that's because we're aware of the danger, and I'm sure that you people that live in flood zones or live next to volcanoes and live in the earthquake zones of California and so on are just as prepared for those eventualities in the locations that you live in as we are here. Now, people that live down on the Gulf Coast and experienced Hurricane Andrew or Hurricane Ivan or Hurricane Katrina or Rita or etc., you people were or should have been or knew or should have known that you were living in a hurricane area, and you should have been prepared for that hurricane. But as I watch the news, I find most of the people that live there aren't. And I reported to you last time, we live in an ice storm-prone area. And from what I can see, between 1987, when we had our last ice storm, and this ice storm in 2007, I can't see that the average Joe Sixpack is any better prepared today than he was 20 years ago. And I would conclude from that that probably the general population, the overall overwhelming majority of people won't be any better prepared 20 years from now than they were in this one. So for those people, turn the dial and go listen to something more intelligent. Now, for the five or six of you that are left, listen to this. Joel Skousen, who wrote the book, a big thick book here, by the way, about 300 pages, on strategic relocation, is a professional. This is what this guy does for a living. He designs places for people to go, or solutions for people who live on the Gulf Coast who know that hurricanes are coming and that they need to prepare for it in advance. That's what this guy does for a living. He doesn't have an overwhelming clientele of people. He works primarily for wealthy people who have money and foresight. And I'm sitting here saying, well, wait a minute, can't those of us that are poor have just as much foresight and plan just as well as the rich? Do we have to be multimillionaire Bill Gates or Warren Buffett's to prepare for a hurricane, to relocate ourselves or strategically position ourselves to save our lives? I reject the notion that I have to be a billionaire to save my life or president of the United States to protect myself from a nuclear attack. I don't think that's true. And neither does this guy Skousen. Now listen to this. He says, I'm going to take a few minutes to give you an overview of my outlook on the world and the humanity that inhabits it. It's important to walk through this process with me so that you can understand why I don't trust the common rosy view of life and people that others possess. I firmly believe that excessive optimism or positivism can lead to a partial blinding of our abilities to see the future, especially when we're dealing with illusions of peace, prosperity, and security. It's my sincere belief, after analyzing my personal experience with people over the past 50 years, in combination with a diligent study of history, that it is the inevitable tendency of all societies to slowly degenerate into dullness of conscience, insensitivity to higher moral values, and finally, into general corruption of good judgment. The end result of this process is always the eventual death and destruction of individual societies, one or two at a time, and usually through the instrumentality of war, and sometimes through direct judgments from God Almighty Himself. Other societies in different stages of ascendancy or degeneration, falling enlightenment, do not seem to have the ability to see how they are following a similar destructive path as the Roman Empire and the United States of America. Individuals look upon the wars around them with a variety of emotions, some fearful, others passive, but almost always failing to see or feel anything that would cause them to change direction before they pass that same point of no return. And sadly, I feel that Western society has passed that point of no return. It isn't that it can't be turned around, it's just that it won't be turned around. One must understand the innate tendencies of most humans to know why that is true. In order to examine if this is true, let's see why most people fail to come up to a significant level of enlightenment and proper action. Even though there are still a lot of good people on planet Earth today, they almost all, unfortunately, suffer from soft thinking habits. First of all, ignorance about what's really going on in life is surprisingly prevalent today. A wise history professor once said that something that I thought was very shocking. He said, "Anyone who claims to know the history of the world and yet knows nothing about the secret acts of conspiring men does not know much about history." So, even if you read a daily newspaper every day, you will never really know what's going on in the world behind the scenes. Indeed, it's nearly impossible for the good men to know certain crucial facts, because most evil acts are planned and carried out in secret. Only very occasionally do the perpetrators make mistakes big enough for a conspiracy to show its ugly head, and even then, it is downplayed and then covered up very quickly by the establishment news media, which is often knowingly, or perhaps even unknowingly, controlled by those same hidden power groups. Now, another reason why good people fail to learn the lessons of history is that such lessons require a recognition that we are guilty of harboring similar patterns of failed thinking and failed performance, both individually and communally. But the Western world doesn't want to hear about that, let alone make the hard personal changes and decisions that are necessary to avoid these disasters. There's an absolute necessity to become self-disciplined, self-controlled in our physical desires, resolute in overcoming personal weaknesses, and sensitive to the promptings of conscience if a society is to survive indefinitely. There is an inseparable link between this delicate control of mind and body and the ability to perceive higher intellectual and spiritual truths, not necessarily because higher truths are fundamentally less comprehensible, but because most people resist truth and truths that require difficult change or make them feel uncomfortable. And that's why, among other things, we have increasingly worse political and moral judgment in society, despite increased education. People are selectively choosing to believe and remember only what they want to. And it's true that educators and textbook writers in general are hostile to the free market truths and willfully skew educational doctrine in favor of statism and socialism. But the fact that some students somehow perceive the evil of what is being presented, even without directly knowing why, is strong evidence that some are more subject to the subtle effects of extreme enlightenment than others. Sadly, these persons have always been in the vast minority in the world. Now, I'm not a believer that man is only a product of his environment or his education. People have innate tendencies and attractions from birth that any perceptive mother of multiple children can attest to that. And each individual works hard at resisting any form of education that does or goes against what they want to believe. And they seek after certain ideas that they are naturally attracted to. Unfortunately, the softest and the worst ideas seem to predominate with most people. This downward corruptive tendency has much more to do with people's innate weaknesses than it does with bad education, which is often perpetuated by other soft-thinking people who become teachers, or worse yet, teachers of teachers. Despite my criticism of teachers in general, I recognize that there are some notable exceptions. Few of these, however, have the insight to see that the entire educational system that they help support is fundamentally corrupt, taking everyone's tax money to give free education indoctrination to the majority's children and allowing nothing for those who object out of principle. This problem that I'm describing has much to do with the innate resistance of humanity in general to the tough truths that would lead to enlightenment. Most people want comfort, the easy way, the least painful way, the way of least conflict with other people, and the least conflict with their own weaknesses, which never leads to real stability or happiness, or in the long run, security either. It leads to endless susceptibility to the enticements of soft doctrines, which only give the illusion of effectiveness while exacerbating the problem in the long run, such as the positive mental attitude and the validation theory that promotes the I'm okay and you're okay philosophy. It promotes, for example, the illusions that out-of-control criminal minds will reform if given enough understanding and self-esteem therapy. It promotes the idea that rebellious children will come around if given enough unconditional love and acceptance, and the notion that communist dictators really want to reform and be reformed by giving them enough aid and military concessions. I could go on and on, for the list of human judgment errors is endless and sadly fatal in the long term as well. Now, recently, an interesting survey of American fears surfaced, which confirmed what I have just indicated about Western society's propensity to be soft on people, soft on punishment, and soft on crime. They want the results of tough action without having to be tough. It hasn't worked, it doesn't work, and it won't work. And here's the evidence. Roper Starch Worldwide was commissioned to do a survey on what Americans are comfortable with and what they are not comfortable with. And incredibly, 87% of Americans indicated that they are comfortable and satisfied with the direction their lives are taking, and this despite multiple divorces, numerous problems with children, and multiple financial mistakes. This is very important, or a very important contradiction, since it tends to give strong evidence that most people downplay their root problems and would rather be hopeful in their muddling through than make substantive changes that would actually correct their problems. And also, contradictory is the fact that only 13% of Americans are satisfied with the direction that the country is going in. And yet they keep voting for the same people and the same government programs that they're not happy with or satisfied with. Now, what this really says is that people don't like the results of their benefit, corruption, and permissiveness. But they're fooled into believing that they need more and better implementation of these failed programs rather than less in order to get things straightened out. And that's why so many people vote for socialist solutions, regardless of the party that promotes these socialist solutions, and even despite their professed beliefs in freedom. They simply don't know the difference anymore. Now, Americans say that they want the judicial system to be tough on crime, and yet only 58% say that they would be comfortable sitting on a jury that had to deal with the death penalty. You could say that 58% is really pretty high, but it isn't, considering the fact that defense lawyers are experts in making sure that few of those 58% ever make it to the jury box in the first place. Only 60% of Americans feel comfortable sentencing a violent minor, a child, to life in prison. More ambivalent, 77% say that they would be uncomfortable voting for a politician who is unfaithful to his wife, but election results prove otherwise. The majority of politicians with flagrant reputations for immoral behavior continue to be elected and reelected by substantial margins. And also, the vast majority polled feel that illegal immigrants have no right to free public education in the United States, but only 31% would have the courage to demand the end of this practice. While over 75% say that affirmative action is discriminatory and divisive, fully 42% would not feel comfortable ending the policy. Millions of soft-thinking voters feel sorry for chronic welfare people, or at least the sympathetic images of them promulgated in the press, and subsequently they vote to continue their benefits. It's too bad that these people cannot see the hidden victims, those whose money is siphoned off in ever-increasing taxes and regulations, and those who are not hired because of contractions in the emerging labor market. Nobody feels sorry for them. Being a realist, above all, I can't help feeling somewhat pessimistic about the future probabilities for peace and prosperity in a society such as ours, a society which is overconfident in its soft thinking, educated to excess, sensitive only to the comfortable things that it wants to hear, and thereby lacking in any real wisdom. But now, having said this, I do have hope and positive feelings for the enlightened minority, who are a relatively small group of people scattered throughout every community. People just like you and me, who seem to sense that something is wrong with the world, despite all of the glitz and all of the hype and all of the positive spin from the establishment media and the political sources. So this book is written for them, that small minority of people, to hopefully give them a strategic ability to analyze the long-term trends that will affect their safety and security so that they can maneuver accordingly. Now, having seen fit to buy this book, I would hope that you're one of those enlightened types that I'm trying to reach and assist. You most likely are a person who at least is considering changing locations. Though your individual reasons may vary, I've tried to structure my analysis and data so that it can be used by people of differing points of view, even if yours differs from mine. So if you're a person of unbounding faith in humanity, please don't be offended by my rather negative worldview. After all, it comes from the Roman Empire. But even if you disagree, it is usually a safer strategy to heed the voice of warning rather than the voices of optimism, as long as the voice of warning is reasonable and not taking you in some foolhardy direction. If the pessimistic course is right, then you're ahead of all the others who remain unprepared. If problems are delayed or they don't come to pass, you're no worse off for your preparations. Even better, you'll have slept better during the inevitable ups and downs that come along the way. So let me explain briefly why I have taken the time to express my view of the world and humanity. The threats that you perceive in life have much to do with how you view people and the likelihood of future problems. So, if you are the type that downplays most negative human behavior or views it as non-threatening or exceptional, rather than pervasive, you will not tend to see certain threats that really do exist just under the surface. For example, most of my neighbors have children that are so-called good kids. But these same children are already heavily drawn into bad social and mental habits, which are common to most public school teenagers. Simply because they aren't breaking any major laws or joining gangs doesn't mean that they're headed for other types or that they are not headed for other types of trouble. Over half of these so-called good kids will end up with significant moral indiscretions, and a good portion will become susceptible to depression and bad attitudes. They will often be drawn into bad music and feel no attraction to good ideas. They may even learn to hate learning and to hate work. Perhaps even more damaging for the long term is that most of these so-called good kids have never been taught or expected to use real self-control to overcome these bad attitudes and habits. And this is going to lead to multiple problems in adulthood, and it will leave them totally unprepared to raise their own children in the future. Permissiveness in parenting is rampant worldwide nowadays, and a teenager's multiple rebellions against the little, almost whispering promptings of conscience, are much more serious than parents think. Developing a habit of disregarding conscience or rationalizing away these promptings will cause chronic bad judgment to develop and deepen throughout adulthood. They will often make bad marriage choices, raise children very poorly, have unstable employment, eat a lot of junk food, and make many bad financial judgments. You may not think that these are fatal errors, but when they're all added up together in society, they do become fatal, as they affect the body politic as a whole. They end up contributing to a lot of bad voting, bad choices in education, bad health, and an even worse set of children born in the next generation. And all of these equates to an inevitable downward spiral of performance in society. It's the destruction of the Roman Empire, and it will be the destruction of the American Empire. Now, how can you accurately predict future trends in social unrest and political pressures if you don't see or understand the seriousness of these little things? Even the things that most parents dismiss as normal are in fact serious if you could trace how they transform themselves into uglier adult problems over a lifetime. And yes, they may be normal, but the best families must not follow the norm. They must prepare to live a significantly higher lifestyle if they are to survive these downward and fatal trends. And I cannot emphasize enough how living a tighter, higher lifestyle is essential to developing insightful and critical judgment. You cannot develop good strategic judgment without a very detailed and accurate view of what's going on around you. Some of this involves getting access to the right sources of news and analysis. And I'll give you some leads later on. But the most important source is your own conscience and your own spiritual receptor in the mind that'll give you that gut feeling or that hunch which you must learn to follow. You can actually improve and enhance your ability to be sensitive to your feelings by giving them more attention and the following and then following those promptings. I've got two small rules which will help you more than any others to develop increased sensitivity to the truth when you see it, and an increased ability to follow through with it. Never do anything that you feel nervous about as to the correctness of it. And two, always force yourself to do what you know you should do, especially when you don't feel like doing it. So I hope you're amenable to these ideas and thought processes, and although I know I'm probably speaking to many parents who have made many of these same mistakes that I've just mentioned, take heart. It's never too late to turn your own perceptions and poor habits around, although it may be more difficult the longer you wait. And besides, you may be able to influence your children when they're adults. And this is a call to renewed action. I hope this book will encourage you to make some of these beneficial changes in your lives and the lives of your children. I think that's a very wise observation on Skousen's part. You know, I'm getting to be an old man now, and he seems to be about as old as I am, maybe a little older. And after you live for 50 years, and you've observed all of these events that have transpired over your lifetime, you know, you take a look at the mistakes that people make. You take a look at your own mistakes in life, and you say, geez, I don't think I would have done that a second time. I'm not sure I would have. In fact, I know now I wouldn't have married that woman that I married the first time around. That's what anybody that's divorced could tell you. Hey, I made a mistake when I married that woman, or I made a mistake when I married that guy. Well, was there a way that you could have made a determination before you married that you were making a mistake? Is there something out there that's different in other societies or in other circumstances that would help you avoid that error? Well, the answer to that is yes. You betcha. There's lots of people out there that are married, never got divorced. They did something different than you and I did. Now, there are things that people do in life that make them survivors, make them wealthy, make them prosperous, make them successful. Sometimes they're criminals, like the Bush crime family, as a lot of people refer to them. And those crime families end up dead. Have you ever noticed that the lifespan of certain people isn't quite as long as others? I've mentioned to you that the Mormons and Adventists live a little longer than average. The average American Joe Sixpack lives to be 75. Mormons and Adventists live to be 80 or 82. Why is that? Maybe only 7 years, but you know, 7 years of lifespan longer is a little better than 7 years of lifespan shorter, isn't it? I'm not too anxious to run off and die in the morning. I haven't run across very many people that are just waiting and chomping at the bit saying, geez, I can't wait to die. Now, if we want to be successful, then there's something we've got to do different. If you want to be a survivor from the Titanic, you're going to have to do something different than the victims from the Titanic. If you want to be successful, we need to learn from the people in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast about hurricanes. We need to learn about these ice storms, these natural disasters. We need to learn from this war in Iraq, the war in Bosnia, World War I and World War II. The events that have gone on historically in the past are things for us to learn from. In fact, Bible prophecy, the scriptures themselves, say that all of these things happened as examples or in samples for us to learn from. So let's pay attention now to some of the wise heads around us, and let's take a look at the history that has gone on before us and see if we can't avoid the same errors, the same penalties, the same problems that have happened to people in Dresden, Germany, Berlin, New Orleans, San Francisco, and every other location where something tragic has occurred. What could we do today that would prevent that from happening to us, you and me, tomorrow? Tall order. We'll get right after it, right after this. But let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Keep in mind, however, that these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate by endorsing or recommending the law or an editorial review. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or a local radio station. If you'd like more information about the law or an editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. And let me give you a couple of reminders here. We have a health class coming up February 5th through the 9th, and we have an Austin tax class on February the 26th through March the 2nd. So tax and status in Austin, Texas, for those of you that live down there in the big state, Austin, Texas, February the 26th through March the 2nd. If you'd like more information, call the law school and ask us. And then our health class, February the 5th through the 9th, if you're suffering from a degenerative disease, or if you would like to prevent, which is what I always recommend, if you'd like to prevent degenerative disease, remember there's 18 health laws. If you practice those 18 health laws, you will not get cancer. And if you violate one or more of those 18 health laws, you need health insurance. Now, we're talking about strategic relocation, a North American guide to safe places to live. Safe places to live. The publisher is Swift Learning Resources, American Fork, Utah. They have a phone number. It's 1-800-292-2831. Again, that's 1-800-292-2831. And it's copyrighted by Joel M. Skousen, who's the author. Joel, J-O-E-L, M. Skousen, S-K-O-U-S-E-N. Back in 1998, all rights reserved. Contact the author if you'd like to get a copy of the book, Strategic Relocation. Now, I rate this about a 1 in 100 read. You'll read 100 books before you read another one like this one. Now, I rate them 1 in 20. And you'll read 20 books before you get one like this, or you'll read 1 in 100. I read a lot of books, and this guy's got his act together, and I think he's got a hell of a story to tell. And that's why I'm recommending it. The author is 290 West, 580 South. Those guys out there in Utah have some weird addresses. So you write 290 West, 580 South. Orem, O-R-E-M, Utah, 84058. They got a telephone out there, too. It's 801-224-4746. Again, that's 801-224-4746. Or you can go to the email. It's jskousen, all one word, J-S-K-O-U-S-E-N, at enol.com. I'm going to flip over here to about page 181. And I'm going to give you some excerpts from the book, which is divided into three sections. He starts off with basic preparations for a Maine residence. And he talks about things like an analysis. The threat analysis, the ideal criteria, and an analysis of U.S. counties and states, putting it all together. And the thing that really caught my eyeball here was the analysis. It is so detailed that he has a county-by-county analysis of safe places in the United States. And remember, this is a guy, this is a fella who makes his living putting these retreats together for the intelligentsia of America, like George Bush and Ted Kennedy. And he wrote this book, and I guess he figures the same way I do, that if it's good for the elitists, why isn't it good for waitresses, truck drivers, and carpenters? And I think that it is, and he and I agree on this. It's certainly possible for those of us that are down here at the lower echelons of society. No, I'm not one of the elitists. I don't make $1 billion a year like Bill Gates. And I don't begrudge Bill Gates having a retreat, having a subsistence and survival plan, and planning to live to be 110 years old. I just think that all the rest of us ought to be warned also. And I'm not asking for Bill Gates to send me any money to help me prepare. Just give me a little warning. Hey, just send me a message and tell me, hey, listen, here's what we think's coming, and that's why I'm selling all my stock. That's what I reported to you last week. Bill Gates is selling all his stock in his own company. How come if he's selling his stock in his company, we're not selling our stock and getting the hell out of the market also? So on page 181, Skousen starts off in the section called Putting It All Together. And he says in this section, I'm going to try to bring together for my readers all of the divergent elements that we've been analyzing and show you how that I would narrow down and sort things out in order to arrive at a relocation conclusion. So first of all, let's go through the various threats that are relative to our national choices. And I'll cover them in a different light when discussing regional or state choices when we get through. So let's take a look at the conclusions on a national level. When we're talking about natural disasters, there are not very many national issues that are involved here, since almost all disasters are localized in various regions. However, overall, I would say that Canada is the least prone to natural disasters. Canada's main central core of land area is stable, non-earthquake territory, and it's less prone to generate the number of severe thunderstorms, as we see here in the continental United States. Desert regions, common in the United States and Mexico, are fairly free from these natural disasters, and that's because most storm damage is linked to wet weather problems, such as wind, flooding, and tornadoes. Deserts also tend to be less populated, so that even in an earthquake, damage is limited. Mexico has many areas that are fairly dry and barren, and therefore relatively free from many of these natural disasters. The major disadvantage that Mexico has relative to natural disasters is the type of construction that is used in buildings in Mexico, in buildings and houses. And that's because almost everything in Mexico is built from cement or clay products, including the roof structures. This type of construction is relatively inflexible, and combined with a lack of steel reinforcing, tends to disintegrate under stress. Earthquakes, then, are a major threat to the entire Mexico Peninsula. And frankly, I would feel very uncomfortable under almost any concrete roof during an earthquake in Mexico. Now, a final factor is the ability of the nation to respond to natural disasters. There are actually two aspects involved here. First is the availability of external, which is usually governmental assistance, and two, the ability of the people to be self-sufficient in their local area and then fend for themselves, reverting to the live-off-the-land mode, so to speak. Now, the United States has the highest resource level for disaster response and aid in terms of throwing money at the problem. Now, while I don't agree that it is the general taxpayer's responsibility to bail out people who choose to live in high-risk areas of the country, certainly, the United States has the largest base of resources to respond with. This nation could do even better if it promoted preparedness and personal responsibility for risky choices, rather than mere monetary after-the-fact band-aids such as we see going on after Hurricane Katrina. In terms of natural self-sufficiency, everywhere in the United States except the desert Intermountain West qualifies for basic self-sufficiency. Southern Canada does well in this regard also. Although the growing season is very short in Canada, clearly, most areas of Mexico are at risk in this area of self-sufficiency, although I would say that its campesinos are much more likely to survive since they're used to living on a much more meager diet than the typical American or Canadian. This factor of natural self-sufficiency will become even more important during very large disasters that will inevitably come in the future, since no amount of government aid will be sufficient. Now let's take a look at the health risks. Mexico has a certain advantage here, since the government allows a much wider array of personal liberty to pursue alternative health care treatments. Unfortunately, most Mexicans never use these facilities, being drawn into the subsidized state medical system instead. Most conventional drugs are about one-fourth the price in Mexico compared to their brand name counterparts here in the United States and Canada. However, on the negative side, Mexico has the highest rate of bacterial and microbial contamination in the food industry and the water supply, with a commensurate high risk for large-scale public health problems. The typical Mexican also is very deficient in knowledge on how to acquire proper organic nutrition in a polluted world. And while supplement availability is high, the use of these products is dangerously low. In Mexico, the risk of large-scale epidemics is fairly high, and this is especially so in the cities. Canada has the most socialistic of healthcare systems, and while this system still has many adherents, especially among its doctors, it is destined to become even more meddlesome and inefficient as time goes on. People just never seem to be able to see the effects of long-term disincentives towards self-care that are produced when governments attempt to shield the people from their consequences of bad nutrition with insurance and government safety nets. The costs of a free, universally available system can never be successfully contained, especially in an atmosphere where the establishment system increasingly relies upon drug intervention rather than good nutrition and prevention. Now, this is a recipe for ultimate disaster. And on the other hand, rural Canada is the clear winner in terms of healthy living. The moderate to lightly populated areas just north of the high-density border areas are almost always pollution-free and are bathed by a constant flow of non-polluted air masses from the north. Canada also has the best water on the continent, speaking as a nation in general, of course. Now, the United States has a mixed record of both healthy rural areas and high pollution inner city zones. And though biological contaminants are minimal in this country, chemical contamination of the water and air are a problem in almost every metropolitan area of the country. However, do individual responses to these threats, coupled with the failure of traditional medicine to provide healthy solutions, there's a big movement here in the United States that is turning to alternative medicine and protesting pollution and chemical additives. And thanks to the free market that still abounds here, the downside is that the medical establishment in control at both the federal and state levels keeps trying to shut down this alternative health care path. So in summary, Canadians need to take advantage of their cleaner and healthier environment, but cross the border for certain types of medical care when their own coercive socialist health care system fails to provide efficient or timely service. U.S. citizens need to seek out non-polluted areas, fight to keep their health care system private, and then seek out more effective medical alternatives to the establishment habit of treating the symptoms with drugs. The Western United States are far more advanced than those in the East in terms of allowing alternative medical practices. It's hard to find many products in the East that are common here in the West, where buying practices seem to be very tradition-bound. Now let's take a look at crime and social unrest. Canada is the clear winner here for now. The only drawback is Canada's hostility to its private citizens having guns for self-defense. In the long term, I wouldn't want to be in a country without the last bastion of liberty, a firearm. But for now, the crime risks in Canada are lower than they are in the United States. And over time, I predict that this will not remain so, especially in the major metropolitan areas of the Great Lakes, which are close to the border influences of more criminally prone American cities such as Detroit, for instance. Now, in contrast, the French regions of Quebec are near no major U.S. cities and will keep culturally separate for nationalistic reasons, some good and some, I think, unwise. Overall, Canada clearly shows a cultural propensity to a slower increase in crime than United States cities whose moral values are rapidly disintegrating. Now, Mexico has a type of institutionalized corruption that is built into its legal and administrative structure. The systematic giving and taking of bribes is the primary characteristic. And this is due to both legal and bureaucratic excesses and a certain tendency of certain Latins to lord it over other people. It is that infamous macho mentality. This system corrupts almost every employee who has any real power to apply regulatory barriers or monetary damages to others. As a counterbalance to these tendencies, there is the natural inclination of the rural campesinos to be good-natured and honest. They're naturally a warm, good-hearted people, except when they get corrupted by the excess materialism of the border areas with the United States. The only major liability that I see in Mexican culture is the tendency to be seduced by American-style materialism. Many simply cannot resist the temptation to buy all of the latest material conveniences, even when they lack the basic necessities. It seems that even the smallest hovel in Mexico sports at least one TV antenna. They love boom boxes, VCRs, and older luxury model U.S. automobiles. These passions for the trappings of wealth are an addiction to many of the campesino class, and even worse, for the long haul, the Mexican people are very susceptible to the call of the socialist elite who constantly attempt, whether as a politician, a journalist, or an intellectual, to generate feelings of class resentment and warfare among those who are poor in Mexico. Eventually, this will cause severe hostility against America, and it will spill over the border area of the southern United States. Now, Americans living in the border states of the American Southwest need to be aware of this long-term threat. On a national level, the United States also seems to be the leader in using criminal problems to generate draconian legislation aimed at restricting Americans' liberty. Even though this is a negative in living in the United States, it is heavily offset by the residual amount of liberty that is still available in the United States, coupled with the freedom to own private arms for self-defense. In the final analysis, all of the major national threats, crime, social unrest, war, and government tyranny, will all require a fallback to a self-defense area. Even though I fully expect the United States government to generate a crisis of significant proportions, most likely the assassination of another president, to mandate total gun control and eventual confiscation of firearms, I do think that the number of residual arms in the hands of private citizens will still make it the only place on planet Earth capable of resisting and defending against crime and social unrest, and perhaps even organized tyranny. And then there are the economic problems, war and invasion problems, and the government intrusion problems. And as Skousen goes through and identifies these problems, he also comes up with solutions, which is, in my view, the more important. If you hear of a problem and you don't have a solution, my comment is, what do you need to know about the problem for? Hey, I don't need to know about problems that don't have solutions. If I can't solve the problem for myself, I don't need to know about it. It's going to overwhelm me. But if there is a solution to the problem, and if I could implement that solution, you know, I could have saved myself out of New Orleans. In fact, I did. I related to you in the last program my experience in New Orleans. When I saw that ship go by over my head, I said, this isn't any place for little Georgie Gordon. So I didn't relocate to New Orleans. I relocated to another safe area. Now, there are lots of safe areas, and Skousen has identified them county by county nationwide here in the United States. I think for that simple portion of the book alone, it's worth the money. And I don't even know what the book costs. But if it costs $100, it's cheap. And I would imagine it'll be more like $10, $15, $20, maybe $30. It's paperback. One of my students gave it to me. And he said, take a look at this and tell me what you think. I took a look at it and I said, gee, here's a guy that's got his head on straight. Here's a guy that can think. And boy, I'm telling you, from my perspective, you know, you talk to people and we don't have much thinking, and I related that to you last time. You know, we had an ice storm here in this area in 1987. And from what I'm seeing in the news media, the power companies, the utilities, the people are poorer prepared for the 2007 ice storm than they were for the 1987 ice storm. Poorer prepared. So they didn't learn anything from 87. And I doubt seriously that the people down on the Gulf Coast learned anything from Hurricane Camille or from Hurricane Rita or Katrina. They're down there rebuilding again. Now, you know, my common sense tells me that if you can have these hurricanes in the past, you can have these hurricanes in the future. And I can readily understand insurance companies saying, you know, we're not going to issue, we're not going to provide insurance like we have in the past, since we now have the experience. You know, when an insurance company loses a ton of money, they wake up pretty fast. It would seem like to me that the people who live on the Gulf Coast and the people that live in New Orleans can't learn as fast as the insurance companies can learn. Needless to say, the Gulf Coast is not a primary safe place to relocate to. Hey, we're running out of time again. We're going to have to cut it off right there, so let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, talking about strategic relocation. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.